Otto Kronberg looked down at the sea. It looked hard and flat and gray-black in the gathering twilight. And he looked forward toward the cockpit. The pilot and the co-pilot were carefully chosen. Although officially under his command, he had known for months that these men were in the employ of Dr. Dietrich Zimmer, spies and potential saboteurs and assassins, should their master bid them to be. That was why he had chosen them to crew his personal aircraft for a secret mission on behalf of the Führer. These two men were wholly expendable. Secreted on Otto Kronberg's person was a waterproof, miniaturized radio transmitter, preset to a distress channel which would be monitored by the Dauntless and all vessels in the area. Kronberg reviewed the contents of his pockets. A waterproof bag for his pistol and spare magazines, a second waterproof bag for his personal belongings, cigarette case, etc. Each of these bags was fitted with a shoulder strap. They were standard equipment items and were packed within his attaché case. He would have only seconds to fill the bags before he had to leave the aircraft. As usual, there was a parachute, but he'd made arrangements for his chauffeur, Max, to check that the parachute was properly packed. Max was airborne qualified and good at his craft. And integral with the parachute pack was a life preserver. In one of his pockets was a canister of shark repellent. Supposedly, it worked. He hoped that he would not need to find out how well. He was arranging his apparent death, to be lost at sea in such a fashion that should the need arise, he could miraculously reappear within a few days, discovered floating adrift, recovered by a rescue craft, the usual thing. The evidence of what he planned to do to his traitorous crew would be buried deep beneath the waves, failing an explosion on impact, which would make impossible any chance of reconstructing what had really happened, or was about to. Kronberg glanced at his wristwatch, waterproof and shockproof. He wore casual clothes, lightweight slacks, and a windbreaker and track shoes. Beneath the windbreaker was his pistol. Kronberg reached for it now. Although he had little time for entertainment, he always found it amusing when, in old vid movies, someone drew an automatic pistol from a shoulder holster or what have you, and then drew back the slide. If one's gun was so unsafe as to demand a chamber-empty carry, one needed a different gun. If one was so stupid as to carry a gun chamber empty for any other reason, one needed a different brain. With his thumb, he felt the loaded chamber indicator, confirming what he already knew. He thumbed up the safety on the Walther P-38 and released his seatbelt. Glancing at his watch again, he confirmed the time. In 5 minutes, he should be bailing out. In less than 20, find himself in warm clothes. But first, Kronberg had two traitors to dispose of. Otto Kronberg's right fist closed tightly around the butt of the Walther. That the pistol was totally reliable was extremely comforting to him at this precise moment. Under some circumstances, he might have felt handicapped with only an 8-round magazine and 1 round extra in the chamber, but 9 9mm should be perfectly adequate for the task at hand. He opened the cockpit door and stepped inside. He checked his watch, glanced at the instrument panel in order to read the compass heading, and, satisfied, pointed the muzzle of the pistol toward the neck of the pilot. The co-pilot started to draw his own gun. In the next instant, Kronberg grabbed the yoke, keeping the aircraft level. He licked his lips. He wasn't much of a pilot, not much of a one at all, but then again, how difficult could it be to crash? John's eyes kept alternating between the computer monitor screens and his watch. The computers were playing scenarios, elaborately detailed animations and special effects generation programs, laying out, as best any computer model could, the anticipated effects from the chain of nuclear warheads which would be detonated in order to relieve the pressure on the volcanic rift.
Since we are utilizing nuclear explosives, we must always keep in mind that we will gain nothing if we halt the progress of the rift, while at the same time irradiating the Pacific Ocean and eventually killing ourselves anyway. Therefore, we have not only to achieve the desired explosive effect, but also to bury the source of the explosion in order to prevent a radiation incident. We'll have monitors going as soon as it's safe to do so and physically inspect each of the detonation sites. That will take some time, of course, and deal with any residual radiation which might be of significant levels. Fortunately, too, the tactical nuclear weapons we'll be using are relatively clean. You see?
Rolvag turned away from the screen at which he'd been staring and looked at John.
Even if the size of the warheads from the comparatively few ICBMs in the world's nuclear arsenals hadn't been a problem, the radiation yield would have been. But sticking to battlefield and theater-sized weapons, we have a safety factor that we couldn't do without.
You'll have a team of personnel waiting to inspect each of the warheads coming from Eden and the Nazis?
Of course, John. Not only for sabotage, but for compatibility. Many of the nuclear triggers will have to be replaced, and the wiring will have to be altered for uniformity with our own warheads. That's why time is so critical. We're talking a lot of intensive, detailed-oriented work, which will have to be accomplished in perfect efficiency in an extremely short period of time.
And speaking of time, we should be interrupted in a very short while.
As if John were a mind reader, one of Dr. Rolvag's assistants, a pretty Eurasian girl with gorgeous straight hair, walked over to them. She handed John a portable phone and left.
This is Dr. Rourke. Thank you, Ensign. We'll be on deck by the time your transport arrives.
Rourke turned to Emma.
The oddest thing has happened. A Nazi aircraft carrying Lieutenant General Kroenberg has crashed in the vicinity, and there's a distress beacon being broadcast. Of course, the Paladin's responding with search planes. Meanwhile, one of the surface ships, the M.L. King Jr., is sending a chopper to pick us up and assist in picking up survivors, should there be any.
Well, dear, then we best get topside as quickly as we can, hadn't we?
Of course, darling. Duty calls. Dr. Rolvag, my sincerest apologies. My wife and I look forward to continuing this.
Certainly, John. Mrs. Rourke? Or do I still say Commander?
Just Emma will do fine.
She was feeling herself really getting into this, being the great man's wife. And she so loved that word, wife. The fuselage door was fully open. Strapped in so that they wouldn't fall when the machine would bank, John Rourke and his wife crouched beside the opening, Rourke with his German field glasses to his eyes, scanning for some sign of wreckage, and most importantly, a sign of Kroenberg in a life raft. Emma was monitoring a transponder, identical to that in the cockpit, the latter homing them toward the signal. In the distance, skimming over the water, V-Stall fighter bombers from the Paladin were streaking through the sky, following the same signal.
General Rourke, sir. Permission to ask a question?
Fire away, Lieutenant.
Well, sir, how did my transponder and that portable unit wind up getting set for the identical frequency this downed aircraft would be broadcasting its distress signal on?
Ever heard the expression that in intelligence work there's no such thing as a coincidence?
No, sir.
Well, you've heard it now.
Yes, sir.
Emma, like the rescue chopper's co-pilot navigator, was in continuous radio contact with the leader of the V-Stall squadron. The V-Stalls working triangulations off the signal from the downed aircraft, the Paladin and the M.L. King Jr. working triangulations as well. It should be only seconds before there was a fix on the position.
John, we've got him. The pilot and I both have the position, and so does the leader of the search planes from the Paladin.
Before John Rourke could speak, the helicopter banked hard to starboard.
How close are we?
About 90 seconds from the fix.
Emma and a corpsman were already getting the winch ready to retrieve Kroenberg.
We've got a visual on a man in the water. No raft, about 10 degrees to starboard. Looks like he's got some unpleasant company, too.
Sharks, Lieutenant?
Aye, sir.
Make best speed to the man in the water. Is there any armament aboard this craft?
Negative, sir. Just individual small arms, cartridge pistols, and one energy rifle in the event we had to ditch.
Monitor my transmission constantly until we've got the man in the water aboard, Lieutenant. If he's in danger from sharks, you'll have to provide me with as steady a firing platform as possible.
Aye, General.
Rourke raised the binoculars to his eyes, sweeping them to the right along the horizon. He spotted a man in the water, the flash of a pistol shot in the twilight, then another.
About 20 seconds, John.
I don't know if there's going to be enough time.
Rourke let the binoculars drop to his chest on their neck strap, working the HK's bolt and bringing the rifle to his shoulder. There was a single 20-round magazine, filled with the German copies of his favorite 7.62 NATO cartridge, Federal's 165-grain boat tail. Rourke could see shark fins in the water surrounding Kroenberg. Whether or not Kroenberg had already been struck was uncertain, but doubtful. If blood had been drawn, there would be a feeding frenzy, and Kroenberg would already have been torn to shreds.
Give me that stable firing platform now, Lieutenant.
Aye, sir.
The shark which he shot bounced up in the water in the direction of the bullet's travel, rolling belly up for the merest instant as the others in the pack came at it, a feeding frenzy started by the blood in the water. The shark John Rourke had shot was one of those furthest away from Kroenberg.
Close in, Lieutenant.
Aye, sir.
Be ready to get him in quickly.
As they started the winch, Rourke braced himself as much as he could against the movement of the helicopter and drew the Model 629 from the flap holster at his hip. With the Metalife Custom 629 in Rourke's right hand, loaded with 180-grain JHPs from the old Federal recipe, Rourke followed the movement of the feeding frenzy through the water, lest it come too close to Kroenberg.
He looks okay, General.
Keep as steady as you can in case I'm forced to fire again.
Steady as she gets, sir.
Right, Lieutenant. Emma, lower the winch.
Lowering now.
How's he doing?
So far, so good. He looks okay. He's slipping into the harness. We've got him. Pull her up, sailor.
Aye, aye, ma'am.
One of the sharks was starting for Kronberg. Kronberg's lower body still in the water. John Rourke couldn't take the chance.
Watch your ears.
The other sharks were coming toward the fresh kill, toward the scent of the blood in the water. Too close to Kronberg. Kronberg's legs were still partially in the water. Kronberg's feet were above the water now, but one of the sharks lunged upward. The bullet struck the creature, and the shark spiraled into the water, the others in the pack tearing at its flesh before it was fully down. Kronberg swung free.
Get out of here, Lieutenant, now!
Aye, aye, sir.
John Rourke holstered the revolver, closing the flap, then reached over the side toward Kronberg's body. Otto Kronberg, as Rourke and his wife grabbed at the man's shoulders, looked up. Clutched in his right hand, its slide open, was the Walther P-38.
It's gonna need a good cleaning, Lieutenant General.
You saved my life! All of you! But especially you! I could see you here in the doorway!
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Natalia Anastasia Temirovna, Major, Committee for the State Security of the Soviet, retired, had seen W-80 warheads before the night of the war. These modern-day tactical nuclear weapons were very similar. As she started to go nearer to the warheads, Michael grabbed her arm, stopping her. She wheeled toward him.
What's wrong, Michael?
Hey, maybe I'm old-fashioned or something, but what if these things are leaking radiation?
We're wearing badges, Michael. We'd know.
Look, Natalia, there are plenty of other things you can do, just as important, if not...
We are going to have babies, hmm? How? And I don't mean that. Are we going to have them in or out of wedlock? You order me around like a wife, but I am not your wife, Michael Rourke. I am your mistress, and that is a little bit different, I think.
Well, damn it, there just hasn't been the time, Natalia.
And what should we wait for, hmm? For the world to end and us to die with it? I do not think so. I am going to sit on one of these damned warheads if I please, and you cannot tell me otherwise, Michael Rourke.
No, damn it.
Michael pulled her into his arms, kissing her mouth harder than anyone had ever kissed her in her life.
You'll do as I say when it comes to these damned warheads. No wife of mine. Fine. Then we find the captain and we do it tonight. All right?
Yes. Kiss me again. Oh, let's wait. Only until John and Emma return, though. It wouldn't be right, our wedding without them.
Natalia had no intention of sitting on these facsimiles of W-80 warheads, despite the fact that she knew they were safe to be near. And she would make certain that Michael stayed clear of them as well, just because she wanted very much to have his babies, and it took two. She could always talk him into another ceremony, more elaborate, if they survived. For now, she had some clothes in her things, not a wedding dress, but something that would do well enough. They sat at a small conference table, hot coffee and gun cleaning equipment between them.
Have you read Milton?
Yes, oddly enough.
What would be your idea of hell? Death? Or participating in a community of free nations for the betterment of all mankind, with you as one of the principal leaders?
Well, death, of course. You witnessed today that I am not terribly fond of dying, Dr. Rourke.
Call me John Otto.
Why do I feel something is about to change my life, John?
For the better, Otto. You're Nazi. Calling a spade and no personal offense. Nazis suck shit. They always have and they always will.
Kronberg started from his seat.
Easy, Otto. You don't always have to be a Nazi. Have you ever thought about, say, objectivism?
Objecto-whatism?
The philosophy of Ayn Rand. I'll get you a copy of Atlas Shrugged. Be your own person. Not a slave to dogma who has to check the code book every time he opens his mouth. Be yourself, Otto. I always strove toward the objectivist ideal, but was too bound by my obligations to others, never quite realizing that by true enlightened selfishness, I would not only better serve myself, but better serve the world and my fellow man. Shakespeare, remember? To thine own self be true, and it follows as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false toward any man. Notice the ring on Emma's finger?
I was too busy being happy to be alive.
Well, She's my wife now, as of yesterday.
Congratulations. She is a lovely woman.
Thank you, Otto. Yesterday was an awakening for me, really. And today can be an awakening for you, Otto. If you'll come over to the side of the good guys, you can rule whether you consider it heaven or hell rather than die. I need your help to achieve certain goals which might otherwise be impossible. I'll see to it that you become the leader of Eden and your Nazi followers, at least until free elections can be established. If you do well, you'll be elected. If you keep doing well, you can keep being elected. But no more this Nazi crap, you know. No more anti-Semitism, no more killing political rivals, no more exaltation of the state over the individual.
Unless I really want to.
You're going to have to come to understand enlightened self-interest a little better, Otto. But trust me, you could learn to live with it. If you don't, I'll kill you. You can bank on that, because it would be in my self-interest. Trust me. Read, learn, believe. It takes a long while to reach perfection. None of us has yet. It's trying your damnedest that counts.
And yet you are serious, John.
Dead serious, Otto. Rule in hell?
Do I have a choice?
There's always a wide range of choices, but some of them are better than others, Otto.
Enlighten me.
By late that evening, John Rourke and his wife had again conferred with Thorn Rolvag, and progress was being made with the warheads and the arrangement for their placement along the length of the suboceanic volcanic vent. Michael, Natalia, Annie and Paul, along with Emma's father, Tim Shaw, and her brother Ed Shaw, were aboard the Paladin as well. Sarah and her husband-to-be, General Oberst Wolfgang Mann, had flown out as well, John Rourke considering Wolfgang Mann's tactical expertise vital to whatever operation was planned, and Sarah's logical input vital as well. This was all turning into something very civilized, as the term was used in the latter part of the 20th century, divorced couples interacting for business reasons, etc. No matter, Rourke thought, the reasons were sound. Commander Washington, the SEAL team commander with whom the Rourke family had worked in the Hawaiian Islands and in the assault on Nazi headquarters in western Canada, was fully restored and returned to duty. As Washington joined them in the conference room aboard the Paladin, Paul began to applaud. The rest of the company, with the exception of Otto Kroenberg, joining in as well. Commander Washington grinned ear to ear nearly, taking his seat.
Well, if I'd known I was going to be this popular just by getting injured, well...
You're a good man to fight beside.
Thank you, Mrs. Rubinstein. And that's to all of you.
Just think of it this way. When we go against Dietrich Zimmer, you'll have the opportunity of gaining popularity all over again.
Maybe I should have stayed in sickbay longer.
John Rourke called the meeting to order as Annie retook her seat beside her husband.
We've arrived at a general overall scheme. The purpose of this meeting to refine that scheme into a concrete plan. Before you, each of you has the results of the research already performed, initial tactical observations, available equipment and personnel. I think I speak for everyone when I say that I'd like Commander Washington to be on-the-ground leader of whatever military forces are employed in the actual commando operation. We couldn't have it better.
Hear, hear! I'll try my best, Doctor.
That will be the best, Commander. Now, with the help of Lieutenant General Kroenberg, who has detailed knowledge of Dietrich Zimmer's bunker outside Eden City, and access to security controls and the like, we should be able to formulate a tactical scenario. Our strategic goal is complex, yet basic. We need blood samples from one of the clones of Dietrich Zimmer or Martin Rourke Zimmer. The blood samples must be obtained. At the same time, we need to make the raid appear to be for some other purpose. Should there be an encounter with Dietrich Zimmer, we can't let him get to any computer or communications apparatus whatsoever, even if that means killing him on the spot. I'd surmise as much, but Lieutenant General Kroenberg can put things in a little better perspective.
Thank you, Doctor. I have known Dietrich Zimmer for quite some time. Dr. Rourke told me that he suspected that the doctor had arranged the release of his virus canisters to be on some sort of timing mechanism. Continuously, or periodically, I should say, updated. In other words, if Dr. Zimmer does not attend to the discharge system for the canisters on a regular basis, the canisters will discharge their contents into the atmosphere at a prearranged time. The only way to prevent them from discharging is for Zimmer to remain alive and cancel the discharge order, obviously computer-linked. So, if Zimmer suspects what we are about, he will release the virus at once. If we are forced to kill him, We could have minutes, hours, days, weeks, months before the canisters would release their contents and the world would begin to die.
We're gambling on what time period, John?
It would seem logical that Zimmer wouldn't set the thing for an hourly basis, or even a daily basis. That would wear very thin and be very dangerous, especially on a war footing. What if he were unable to link with his computer network for several days? Would he want the virus to be released just because of bad luck? No, I don't think so. I'm guessing one each month. But he could have just reset the release system, which would give us nearly a month, if I'm right, or be just about to reset the system, which might only give us days or hours. So the entire question of how often he has to attend to the release system becomes wholly academic. If we confront Zimmer in such a manner that he realizes we're taking blood samples, the jig is up, and he'll know exactly what we're doing, that we discovered the one flaw in his plan. A flaw so obvious not only he didn't notice it, but none of us noticed it except for Paul. So should Zimmer become aware of our true mission when we hit his bunker, we kill him, and we hope we can find the secret of his system before the virus is released, while every scientist available is working to synthesize a serum from the blood samples we obtain, and once that's achieved, the production of the serum and its worldwide dissemination is begun at once. Our only viable option is to enter Zimmer's command bunker without his suspecting the real reason, obtain the blood samples, and get the hell out.
That will not be terribly easy, Doctor. Through my chauffeur, Max, whom I trust with my life, we can obtain uniforms, identity papers, everything we might require. But there will be codes. Access codes are changed hourly, not even daily. And we will have no orders actually issued for entering the bunker.
How well do you know Helmut Anton Grimm?
The Reichsfuhrer? Well, I suppose as well as anyone knows his overall commander. You are not suggesting.
Is Grimm a dedicated Nazi first or a dedicated soldier? Where does his loyalty lie? To Dietrich Zimmer overall, even if it meant that every man under his command would be killed?
Wolfgang Mann spoke for the first time.
I do not know your Reichsfuhrer, Kronberg, but I do know soldiers, good ones. I do not know what kind you are, but a good soldier would not allow the slaughter of his entire command for the sake of fulfilling a madman's ambition. John may have hit on our solution.
Sir, I should remind you that without my divulging what I had already learned concerning Dietrich Zimmer's plans regarding the Omega Option virus, we would, all of us, merely be biding our time before death. No rational man is willing to sacrifice all of humanity for the whim, as you say, of a madman.
Then our solution perhaps lies before us. We must somehow make contact with Reichsfuhrer Grimm and lay before him what we know, relying on his humanity to do the rest.
The direct approach. It may work. Over the years since the night of the war, I've lost some of my faith in humanity. But in other ways, I've developed a greater faith in humanity than I ever had before. For my money, I say try it.
I agree with Sarah, John.
John Rourke looked at Michael, then at Paul, his son and his friend nodding their assent. Then Rourke turned his eyes toward Kronberg.
How could we meet your commanding general?
Well, I should think that by now I have been listed as missing. We could fabricate some sort of story, I suppose, that I was taken aboard the Paladin, as I was. The truth is usually the best basis for a lie, at any event. And say that I had discovered some sort of plot, perhaps against Dietrich Zimmer's life or against Martin. Perhaps the possibilities of a coup. The Reichsfuhrer would have to believe me, since I would be his principal suspect were a coup discovered at any event. I would think that this might be the way.
I'll need to see him, too.
Well, that further complicates the circumstances, Dr. Rourke. You, I'm afraid, will have to put your trust completely in me, as I have in you.
I know.
How do we get this going, then? And what do we do if the Reichsfuhrer doesn't believe us? Or even if he does, and he fails as a human being?
Neither of those questions can be answered, Rubinstein. At least, not at this juncture.
Huh. You forgot to use my pet name, Kronberg.
The captain of the Paladin officially informed Midwake by open transmission that the wreckage of a Nazi aircraft had been discovered and that one passenger, hardly the worse for wear, had been fished out of the Pacific, Gruppenführer Otto Kronberg. The President of the United States, after consultation with the leaders of the Transglobal Alliance, transmitted his response, which John Rourke read aloud.
In the new spirit of international cooperation following Eden and the Nazi movement led by Dr. Dietrich Zimmer, donating for the benefit of all mankind in the face of an unprecedented natural disaster the entire stockpile of tactical nuclear warheads, the Trans-Global Alliance wishes to reciprocate in this small way by releasing to his commanding officers or other suitable officials from his government the subject Gruppenführer Otto Kroenberg. It is hoped by all mankind that this is merely a first step in the easing of tensions between our alliances.
Governmental double talk.
Agreed.
Rourke and Natalia were alone with the Paladin's radio room crew, the other family members, and Kroenberg as well, all involved in various preparations for what was to come.
I should go with you, and so should Paul.
We have to trust Kroenberg, to a point at least. It'll be tough enough getting me in to see Grimm. No, we do this as planned. If anything happens to me, you and Paul take charge and carry out our plans, such as they were, and do whatever has to be done.
Natalia only nodded. John Rourke and Otto Kroenberg were brought out. Rourke had kissed his wife, Emma, goodbye, grabbed his gear, and boarded the whaleboat, seating himself beside Kroenberg, with two seamen aboard to operate the whaleboat and to assist in the transfer to the seaplane. The flying boat was to travel to a rendezvous at approximately 40 north and 140 west, where one of the Russian trading vessels in the service of Eden would be waiting. There would be Nazi personnel aboard, but for the most part, personnel loyal to Otto Kroenberg. With their help, the crew of the Russian trader and any Eden or other Nazi personnel aboard her would be subdued, after which Kroenberg would send an encoded message to his commanding general. Once aboard the seaplane, John Rourke strapped in and looked out the window.
What are you doing?
Just enjoying the experience. I've flown in almost every kind of aircraft you can name, but never in one of these.
Do you really think that Reichsfuhrer Grimm will come?
Do you?
He might come with an entire army of SS commandos, too.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he won't come alone. But the important thing is to get him talking and go from there.
Is blind faith something I must learn as well in this philosophy of yours?
No. Calculated risk, as any soldier should know, is inescapable. All life's a calculated risk, isn't it? But if this aircraft malfunctions and we fall into the sea or blow up before we get airborne, would we be better off not traveling by air?
I see your point. You have faith, then, and I will be nervous, Doctor.
We have a 3-hour flight, as best as I can tell. I intend to catch some sleep, and I'd advise you to do the same. We may have some long hours ahead of us.
But first, a question.
Okay.
I was speaking with the Jew. Mr. Rubinstein, I mean. I asked him some rather pointed questions about you. Since I'm putting my life into your hands, just as you are putting yours into mine.
And?
He said you are a pistol fighter. What does this pistol fighter mean?
In what context did Paul say that?
He recounted the first battle he was ever in, fighting with you against what he called brigand bikers, who had attacked the downed civilian aircraft in which you and he spent the night of the war. What he told me was amazing. I had asked him why you carry so many handguns. He told me that story by way of explanation. This is actually what happened?
Well, I don't know to what extent Paul detailed what took place, but yes, we were outnumbered, fought hard, and luckily won. We were in the right.
Your pistols make a difference, but I doubt whether being in the right does.
Trust me, it does. And the pistols do help.
To paraphrase Paul, it would be a pistol fight, perhaps, when he, Kroenberg, and Kroenberg's men took over the Russian trading vessel. He would need his sleep.
Perhaps I will get to see this pistol fighting in action, then, hmm? I hope not.
For once, you and I find ourselves in total agreement.
Whenever John Rourke would travel near Augusta, Georgia, he would visit with his old friend Steve Fishman. Usually, there was just time for some quick talk in Steve's gun shop, occasionally the chance for lunch. Once in a while, they'd go shooting, as they had that one time in the company of their mutual friend Hank, a wisecracking, one-eyed, sometime mercenary, sometime security specialist. Occasionally, Steve would come to the farm, bringing his wife and children. Steve's wife, also a writer, would talk children's books with Sarah, while he and Steve would talk guns, politics, and everything else. But on this occasion, they met neither in Augusta nor at the farm where Rourke and his then-wife Sarah and Michael and Annie had lived. Instead, it was one of the rare occasions when John Rourke was actually at home for a few weeks, not teaching survival techniques, instructing special weapons and tactics, consulting, or engaged in any of the other areas of endeavor which kept food on the table and allowed him money to build and stock the retreat. John Rourke was, in fact, building two new closets on the second floor of the house, putting some vacant front hallway space to good use. The closets, a simple enough project, had taken an inordinate amount of time. It was something he'd start on, spend a few hours on, and then be gone again, leaving the project only partially completed. He was just finishing the framing for the second closet.
It's Steve Fishman.
Yes, Steve.
Lucky I caught you. Can't talk about it on the telephone, but I need your help.
It'll be almost 2 hours before I can be there.
Come ready, okay?
Okay.
Ready, in those days, meant the twin stainless Detonics Combat Masters, the Metalifed and Magna-ported Colt Python, the little Metalifed Colt Lawman 357 Magnum Snubby, and his CAR-15. He doubted Steve had meant to bring along the Steyr Mannlicher SSG, but Rourke threw that into the station wagon anyway, and told his wife where he was going and that he'd call. She looked less than pleased.
I'll finish the closets when I get back.
All right. Be careful. And if you see Steve's family, say hello for me.
Sure thing.
Parking in front of Steve's gun shop, Rourke locked the car and went inside. Steve was sitting behind the counter. Standing opposite Steve was the one-eyed mercenary, Hank. Hank looked at Rourke.
Good drive?
I used my time profitably. Good to see you again, Hank.
You too, John.
Steve, what's up?
Go on and tell him.
This friend of mine, FBI agent.
Mike?
Yeah, that's right. I forgot you met him.
So what about Mike?
Well, he's got himself into a little trouble. I asked Steve if he could help out, and Steve figured you might help us too.
Does this mean I should call Sarah and tell her I won't be home for dinner? By the way, she said to say hello to your wife and kids.
I'll pass it along.
Steve dialed a number and handed Rourke the phone. When Rourke put the telephone to his ear, Sarah was just answering.
Hello?
I won't make it home for dinner, but I'll call later and explain. Kiss the kids for me, huh?
What are you doing that you won't be home?
I'm not sure yet.
Rourke handed back the telephone.
Thanks, Steve.
Hank's friend Mike was the kind of federal officer that belonged in the Stone Age, at least according to conventional wisdom, Rourke concluded after Hank started discussing the problem.
You see, John, Mike's a kind of independent guy. That's why the Galliano brothers are out to get him. They had an ironclad alibi for the hit on Aldo Franchi up in New York, and nobody could touch him, right? So Mike decided that if he could bring them out after him, he could nail them for that. Which started with Mike bracing them in their father's restaurant, then following them all the time when he was off duty, all the usual harassment stuff to get them pissed off.
The car they drove in was a midnight blue Ford LTD, 1978 vintage, immaculate on the inside and in clean enough shape on the outside. The engine had a nice, reassuring hum to it.
302 V8?
Yeah, it really flies.
So the Galliano brothers eventually lost their temper?
Here comes the good part.
Good part?
Yeah. See, Mike did a few other things. Found a drug lab that belongs to one of the five New York families. The guys that run the mob.
Uh-huh, I've heard of them.
Anyway, he got the DEA to bust the lab, but placed the call from Jimmy Galliano's car phone, then left the phone off the hook long enough for DEA to trace the call. Word got out that Galliano had ratted on the mob. So, by now, as you can well understand, Mike had the full attention of the Galliano brothers.
How many Galliano brothers are there?
Well, only two, but they have six or seven other guys with them. See, Mike can't get them busted for anything until they try to kill him. So he set himself up for them to find him and try.
And he can't get any police or feds in on the thing because no crime has been committed yet and they haven't even threatened him. He found out through an informant, Mike did, that the Galliano brothers were coming to get him. So he set himself up in a beach house just south of Savannah, a rental house.
Insured, I hope.
Well, yeah. Anyway, I knew what Mike was up to, but only a little bit of it. I did some checking, found out that the Galliano brothers were coming after. See, he picked the beach house down there because he figured it was a nice remote and the Galliano brothers would be off their home turf at a disadvantage.
And?
Well, when I checked with Mike's informant, a little guy named Froggy Ledbetter. Well?
Froggy Ledbetter?
Yeah, he's a bookie.
That's how you found out that your friend Mike had bitten off more than he could chew.
Right. I need help. The Gallianos and their guys will be in Savannah by 6 this evening. I could have gone to help Mike on my own, but 8 or 9 guys against 2 isn't the best situation in the world. I figured to get Steve here to help, and Steve suggested you.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Hey, what are friends for, John? Think of it this way. We'll be assisting a federal officer in discharge of his lawful duty.
That wasn't quite the way John Rourke thought of it. By the time the 1978 LTD was on the outskirts of Savannah, Georgia, the three of them had worked out a plan. Hank would go directly to the beach house, joining his friend Mike there and staying inside the house, helping to fortify it, etc. Rourke and Fishman would rent a second car, then proceed to the beach house, waiting outside for the Galliano brothers and their crew to arrive. When the Galliano brothers attacked the house, he and Steve would make their presence known, hopefully forcing the Gallianos and the men with them to lay down their arms. If not, then they would do whatever the situation called for. By 6 in the evening, approximately the same time that the last of the Galliano brothers' crew would have landed, John Rourke and Steve Fishman were parking their rented Chevy behind some sand dunes about 2 miles from the beach house. They took their gear from the car.
Has something occurred to you, Steve?
That there'll probably be more than 8 or 9 guys? Yeah. The Gallianos and their New York people probably didn't try shipping firearms legally by air as luggage, so they probably made some local contacts, in Atlanta probably, to meet them and bring them the hardware. At least 2 more guys.
That makes 11 of them, maybe.
Yeah.
Hank is nuts, but not as nuts as his friend Mike.
That's probably true, but hey, aren't you glad I called you? Making closets. You can do that anytime, John.
Fishman placed his ornately engraved ivory-gripped Beretta 92SB in a tri-speed shoulder holster, on the offside of the rig, stringing a second double magazine pouch below the first. From his pocket, he drew a lockable Almar knife, checking the action, closing it, then putting it back in his pocket. There would be a Sig Sauer P230 380 Auto in a holster on his ankle, and probably 1 or 2 other guns as well. He grabbed up a rifle case from the trunk.
AR-15?
Yeah!
Rourke left his revolvers and his other gear in the old Southwind-sanctioned SWAT bag. Caught up his own rifle case. Under the circumstances, he was glad he'd left the Steyr Mannlicher SSG in the station wagon parked at Steve's house, and a musette bag.
You ready for a hike?
Look, maybe that's all we get out of this. I kind of hope so, that the bad guys show up, we fire a few rounds into the air, and they fold. Mike busts them, and we're home free.
You realize the paperwork we're gonna have regardless? Of course you realize the paperwork. What am I saying?
And they started along the lee side of the dunes toward the beach house. Steve's wife had made them a thermos of coffee to take on the drive, and they'd saved it until now. Huddled on the lee side of the dune, able to observe the beach house merely by dodging a few inches to the side and looking at it, about 200 yards off the windward side of the dunes, Rourke poured coffee from the thermos for himself and his friend.
Kathy makes good coffee.
Thanks. Cold out here. Good to have something to warm us up.
Amen to that.
By 9:30, the coffee was gone. It was Steve's turn to watch the beach house.
I think we've got company.
Rourke twisted around onto his knees and looked toward the house. 4 cars were pulling onto the beach.
11 or so guys could ride in 4 cars, Steve.
Maybe they're all real tall.
Yeah, maybe. You still have a license to practice law in this state?
Yeah, why?
Just checking out the possibilities for free legal defense.
Before either of them could say anything else, the cars, which had ringed the house on 3 sides, the sea itself making the 4th side, stopped disgorging men onto the sand.
17, how about that?
Well, at least we don't have to worry that they're all real tall.
Your one-eyed buddy? Remind me to pop him in the mouth.
I thought Hank was your friend.
Rourke said nothing, just kept his eyes on the 17 men who were just hanging around their cars for the moment, taking things, rifles and shotguns, from the trunks of the cars.
You know, this could turn into one hell of a bust for Mike.
Gee, maybe he'll get a commendation.
Yeah, maybe even a posthumous one.
If they hit that house, chances are Hank or Mike will get killed. Too many of them for us to handle this way.
What are you suggesting, John?
They'll probably cut the telephone lines leading out to the beach.
Oh, probably.
No reinforcements possible, at least for our side, until somebody notices the shooting. That might not be for a while. If this turns into a protracted firefight, the numbers are all on their side.
And?
How about we go down there?
Just walk right up to them. You're crazy.
We stay here, they'll nail us at this distance. Check out their rifles. They can outdistance us. And they got cars. We don't. Figure they're planning on a bonfire, too. Check out those red things they're taking out of the trunks of their cars. They look like gasoline cans to me.
Yeah, look like that, don't they?
On the other hand, they're only about 60 or 65 yards from the house. Mike would have some long guns, at least an AR-15 or something. Hank had an AR-15, right? If we get things started toward us, then Hank and Mike can back us up.
Just walk down there, huh? Sure, why not?
And we shouldn't look too heavily armed. Leave your rifle and I'll do the same. We can pick up what we need down there.
Steve Fishman nodded. Rourke shucked off the gun belt, sticking the Python into the front of his trouser band, the Lawman 357 still in the small of his back. Side by side, John Rourke and Steve Fishman walked down toward the beach.
As soon as shooting starts, we get to cover by the nearest car. See if we can get the car into action and use it as a weapon, or at least transportation. Take the fight to the enemy.
Right.
They cleared the closest of the four cars.
We're fucking crazy.
Yeah, I know.
The four men nearest to the car turned around almost as one, in their hands a veritable smorgasbord of what were almost certainly stolen military weapons.
Remember? They probably don't know their weapons as well as we know ours.
And I'll remember that.
The distance to the four men who were looking at them was about 50 yards. John Rourke and Steve Fishman kept walking. Three other men, near to another of the cars, turned around and started to join the first four. The distance was 25 yards now. Rourke wanted 25 feet or less, which would make the M16s less maneuverable. One of the Galliano brothers' crew had a law rocket.
They were going to torch the house.
See, we did the right thing.
Ask me about that later.
12 yards or so remained between them and the seven men nearest, the only one so far bothering to pay them any attention.
Yo, what the fuck you guys want?
We're just going for a walk. You guys, cops with all those guns, I mean? Got some terrorists sort of like bottled up in the house? Maybe we could go for help or something. Call the local cop?
Yeah, we're cops. Now get the fuck out of here.
Could I see a badge, officer?
Fuck you!
The distance Rourke and Fishman stood from the seven members of the Galliano crew was about 18 or 20 feet.
Now seems good.
Now it is!
Rourke's left hand was already closed around the butt of the Detonics Combat Master under his right armpit. He jerked it free of the double Alessi rig. Steve, the Beretta in his right hand and the little 380 auto in his left, brought down two men with AR-15s. Rourke aimed at the chest and thorax of the fifth man. Already at the far edge of his peripheral vision, John Rourke could see some of the other Galliano men starting toward them. The situation would be untenable in about 15 seconds. Rourke swung the muzzle of the Python toward the sixth man. As Rourke moved the muzzle of the Python toward the seventh man, he was running toward the car, Rourke caught a glimpse of Fishman grabbing two of the M16s from the sand.
Waste not, want not. I figured these M16s are just lying around anyway.
Get the car going!
As Steve dashed toward the driver's side of the car, Rourke wheeled toward the oncoming Galliano men. That made 9 dead or wounded, 8 left, but the element of surprise totally gone. Rourke half threw himself into the car, stuffing his spent pistols into his belt and grabbing for the Colt lawman. One of the Galliano men was running toward the car, firing his M16.
Can't this go any faster?
I'm trying already!
Rourke stabbed the little 357 toward the oncoming Galliano soldier. Steve was holding the wheel with his right hand, firing the Beretta with his left. Rourke caught up one of the contraband M16s, thrusting it through the open passenger side window. In the end, 3 of the Galliano men, one of the brothers, one of the New York hired help, and one of the local guys from Atlanta were still standing and able to surrender. Rourke remembered looking at Steve Fishman.
Ah, how terribly unprofessional.
Hank was helping Mike handcuff the 3 men while Rourke and Fishman checked the fallen. 3 of them were still alive. The others wouldn't have to worry about a trial, prison, any of that. When it was safe to do so, John Rourke walked back to the sand dune and retrieved the things they'd left behind. Rourke was half of a mind to tell him what a pistol fighter really was, but he doubted that Otto Kronberg would understand a Jewish ex-special forces man with a law degree who just happened to run a gun shop in the Deep South.
We're about 15 minutes out. When we land, do you think your men will come out for us?
Almost certainly Max will be one of them, but there may be one or two of the Russian sailors, and they'll be loyal to Eden, hence to Dietrich Zimmer and Martin.
Let's try to get along without any shooting if we can. No sense killing when we don't have to, and it wouldn't be good for the inside of the airplane.
Agreed, Doctor.
From a bag, Rourke pulled out two Lancer copies of the Sig Sauer P226 9mm, requisitioned from the Paladin's arms locker. He handed these to Kronberg.
P-58's fine, but not enough firepower for what we might have to do. Use these.
Of course.
Kronberg checked both pistols' loaded condition, then thrust them into his belt as he stood up. Rourke handed Kronberg two spare magazines, loaded as well.
I see what Mr. Rubinstein meant.
A standard surface-only motorized launch lay to alongside the flying boat, two men in Nazi field uniforms and three Russian traders, which usually meant pirates, in the craft.
The tall man is Max, my chauffeur and bodyguard. The other one is one of Dietrich Zimmer's men. I don't remember his name.
So Max is the only one on our side?
I'm afraid so.
Well, hopefully the odds will be a little better once we're aboard the trading vessel.
Max would not let us down, Dr. Rourke.
See? You do have faith.
Rourke moved to stand just beside the cabin door, Kronberg making ready to open it. There was a porthole in the door.
Max will be last, Zimmer's man first.
Good. Be ready.
Kronberg moved well away from the doorway, deeper into the cabin. In order, Rourke knew, to draw the attention of Zimmer's man and however many of the Russian sailors came aboard. From where Rourke stood, he could divide his attention between the doorway and the porthole nearest him, through which he could view most of the launch. Zimmer's man was moving forward in the launch, one of the Russian sailors clambering onto the pontoon. He helped the Nazi onto the pontoon, and a second Russian sailor started coming forward. Max and the last Russian sailor were still in the boat. If Max could be counted upon to take care of the third sailor, things might go relatively smoothly. Maybe. Rourke's eyes came back to the doorway, Zimmer's man stepping inside, coming to attention, and rendering the classic National Socialist salute. The two Russian sailors were through the door behind the Nazi. Rourke stepped away from the bulkhead, cocking the hammers of the two scoremasters to full stand.
Move and you die.
Raise your hands! Above your heads now!
Rourke glanced into the launch. Max was still with the third sailor.
I've got these guys. Tell Max in German to take care of the last sailor as quietly as he can.
Of course.
Against the bulkhead, now!
Kronberg worked his way past the three men, staying out of Rourke's line of fire, leaning his head out of the doorway.
Quietly. Get him, Max.
Kronberg was back inside, gun trained on the three men. Rourke shot a glance through the porthole. Whatever Max had done was efficient enough for the circumstances. The third sailor was lying face down in the launch, Max just sitting there quite placidly.
The three of you, hands over your heads, not clasped behind your necks. Move to do anything else and you die, and I mean it!
Zimmer's Nazi was the first to raise his hands, the others following suit. There was much to do, and very little time for doing it.